right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again, although in a certain way at least, here we are for the first time. Dom, it is our first episode here with the new format. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling great, and thank you for asking me. I know you have been scolded recently for not asking how I'm doing and checking in on me as often as you should, so good to see you paying attention to that. But as for the episode itself, I'm very excited to dive into this. This is a somewhat experimental new format that we're trying, and we have tried to dabble in various different things in the past, but usually that was kind of just appending something to the end of our usual 2-hour long marathon episodes, or it wasn't really reinventing the wheel in any meaningful sense. This actually is a new type of thing that we're trying, and hopefully it succeeds and we get to continue doing this going ahead.
Okay, so massive deviation right off the bat here, but I do feel like this is potentially at least worth flagging up. We just moments ago recorded our kind of explainer episode talking through what the new format is, and in that you said something to the effect of, like, you know, we'll see how it goes, and that's our focus in the short term. And now, right off the bat, I'm just a bit nervous that you may not be fully sold on this. Dom, if you were not fully sold on this, please tell me.
No, I'm in. Let's do it. Okay. You sound more nervous than I am. Let's go.
Okay, I certainly am nervous at this moment. This is, I feel like, a pretty big deal for the two of us. You know, this is we've been doing this for 9 years, and this is, I feel like, a pretty, at least potentially, going to be a pretty clear kind of line in the sand here, drawn by Coach Wade himself, perhaps. And so I'm looking forward to all that we have kind of in front of us here. I just want to make sure, before we, you know, get pot committed too much here, that you were definitely feeling the same way. But I am now totally reassured here, Dom, and excited to dive into our first main topic ever with the new format, and we're gonna do this one time and one time only, at least anytime soon. Dom, our main topic here today: did Russell Hantz save Survivor? And not only did Russell save Survivor, but I think as I was coming up with different routes that we could go here, I do think even beyond just like viewership and motivating the producers to have a more dynamic kind of game by force rather than by hoping people flip on each other in the form of like more idols and so forth, as we will certainly get into, I do think not only just saving Survivor, but just the long-term effect, both positive and negative, that Russell has had on Survivor over the last 10 years, because we are now past the 10-year mark of Russell essentially monopolizing the Survivor airwaves and take waves back when Twitter and podcasts were first kind of becoming a thing in 2010. And I do still think we are feeling the effects of that specific year to this day.
Yeah, I know it's popular among historians, history teachers, or anyone in that general space to say that it really is inadvisable often to teach current events through a historical lens, because you don't know what history will have to say about them as that history itself is being written. And I don't know if in 2010 and even in 2011, 2012 and so on, we really had the distance and the long-term appreciation of the kind of broad arc of Survivor to see exactly what changes Russell would leave long-term. Now I think we do. It has been, as you say, over a decade. I think that is long enough to draw some definitive conclusions. And I don't know if this is a sensible place to draw that line in the sand with your one index finger or whatever. But now that Russell is officially old school, you know, his first season in Samoa is in the first half of Survivor seasons, which would have seemed so such a remote prospect if someone had mentioned that to you back in 2010. But firstly, there was no guarantee that the show would still be on the air here in 2020, which I guess right now it's not, so I don't want to jinx that for good. But even if you knew the Survivor juggernaut would keep on just rumbling through the TV landscape, just the idea of eventually this will be in the kind of the first half, the archives of Survivor, would have seemed just ludicrous at the time, even if you knew it was just mathematically inevitable at some point. But we have reached that point now, and I think that does give us the perspective or at least the chance to get a perspective that we need to analyze that.
It is crazy to think about, just like when we first started doing this in 2011, the seasons we were talking about as modern Survivor at the time are now like legit classic Survivor.
Pretty historic. Yeah,
we're like a top 40 radio station that just kept playing the same songs long enough that we became an oldies station. But I do think it's actually worth kind of going back to not even 2010, but 2009, I guess, would have been when they were first filming Samoa. Samoa did air in 2009, I want to say. I believe that is correct. And I believe it is the case that even preseason then, they were hyping up Russell big time. Like, all of the promotions they were running were about how, oh, you got to check out Survivor this season. This guy is going to be the biggest villain in the history of the franchise. And they certainly weren't lying, as far as I'm concerned. I know I said this before, but I feel like it's not totally unfair, at the very least, to say that Russell was basically the main character of Survivor, both the TV show and the discussions that were being had for a solid calendar year, and then for a little while again, the next calendar year when he was back briefly on Redemption Island. Dom, the controversy surrounding his kind of like consecutive 39-day runs through the games that he played on back-to-back seasons, both of which ended in losses that he, at the very least, was not happy about. And there were certainly plenty of people who thought that Russell was one of the all-time robbed goddesses in Survivor history. And I'm sure back in 2011, we were talking about a lot of those things as like current events. But in 2010, I always think this is worth flagging up whenever Russell comes up. A young lad in England first heard about Survivor because of the controversy about Russell, right?
Yeah, so Russell officially doomed the Survivor discourse by introducing me to it and motivating me to sink my teeth into the back catalogue of Survivor, which was a much less formidable prospect then than it is now, not just because you only had half of the Survivor seasons back then, but also because it felt like in some ways the show was more accessible, and I don't just mean less arcane terminology that is assumed as prior knowledge as like this barrier to entry, but also just I could go on YouTube and watch old Survivor seasons, and that lack of friction when it comes to locating the seasons and then being able to find people to talk about them with, I think was instrumental in motivating me to complete that project and not just have this as, I guess that show's cool, and when it comes back in the autumn, then maybe I'll check it out again. This was, I know that I'm going to have 4 or 5 months before the show comes back, and I'm going to use that time to watch as much Survivor as humanly possible.
Yes, I think that went a long way in the form of OG YouTube, where legends like Quirky Dude with Big Brother and Stentalizer with Survivor and many other accounts were able to just like post all of these episodes in 4 separate parts and let people like me, who were casual Survivor fans for so long, really become super fans and rewatch these seasons over and over and develop a much deeper appreciation for the show. And I don't know ultimately if the powers that be would necessarily deem that a good thing. Like, I would suspect they are not big fans of the pretty overt kind of copyright infringement going on there, and are not probably of the opinion that developing some very fringe percentage of additional superfans is necessarily worth the cost there. But I think as far as the superfan community as we know it today, that kind of wild, wild west YouTube era and the subsequent ways of watching these shows online, either legally or illegally, has been an enormous difference maker as far as the Survivor kind of fan community has gone is going, and obviously the increase in activity on social media, and there are tons of different contributing factors. But I think the factor they would be most concerned with as far as all of that goes is what is keeping the ratings up. And I think that is a worthwhile place to dive in here on Russell, because you know, the kind of clickbaity headline that I would use here is like, did Russell save Survivor? And we'll probably shamelessly use that exact headline as the podcast title here. I don't think the answer is necessarily yes, but in researching the actual ratings a bit, I don't think it's necessarily no. Survivor did seem to be pretty steadily losing viewers, and to check in with some seasons leading up to it, Micronesia and Gabon were averaging right around like 12, 13 million viewers per week. Tokenshins was noticeably dropping a bit, more in the like 11, 12-ish range, occasionally some 13s in there, but it's something of a decline. Season 19, mostly 12s, 13s, and pushing 14 in there, which in the year 2009 is a big deal. And I think Russell would say, and perhaps the CBS executives would say, that is the bottom line of what matters. And I do think, at least if that is the priority for you, a case can be made that Russell went a long way in helping Survivor get out of, while it was a run of seasons that I think we, Dom, have come to appreciate a lot with the benefit of rewatches and so much time passing, I don't know that this was necessarily a stretch that was enthralling the casual fan.
Yeah, so those figures always require more explanation, and you can get pretty granular when you dig down into it. And I remember when we had Max Dawson on the show, even before he was on the show Survivor back in 2013, 2014, one of the points that he was very clear about making was that this was an era where the reliability of traditional TV ratings was already starting to decline. And you talk about Nielsen ratings and people having all these different ways to watch a show. And that task for him as a media professional, whose job it was and then later became again to acquire this data for TV companies and to make sense of it, it turns out it is not trivial to gauge exactly how many people are watching a show at any given time. And then if you're an advertiser, of course, it's not just a question of how many eyeballs are there on the TV set, is how engaged are these viewers, and what kind of people are these, and so on. So a lot of questions arise out of that. But if you just look at some of those raw numbers with those caveats, you do get this bump with Samoa on the whole. But again, it depends on where you look. So the premiere for Samoa was curiously low rated, actually, compared to both other premieres of preceding seasons and then some of the later seasons, and also just compared to that season itself, the numbers for the later episodes. So you can debate whether this is this excessive focus on Russell alienating viewers, if anything, or if it's a case of the numbers were in such a precipitous decline for whatever reason that it actually took Russell bumping them up to keep them at that level, and were it not for him, they would have plummeted even further.
So my deduction would be the premiere was lower because people did not know what to anticipate with Russell, and then once they got one taste of Russell, it spread like relative wildfire, as much as wildfire can spread on network TV in the year 2009.
So do you have a sense of how those numbers change over the course of the season then?
I could look it up again. I already kind of skimmed it yesterday and will not be doing so. But I did notice, and I think anyone who themselves wants to go on Wikipedia and just look, I was only looking at the how many millions of people are watching figures, which I don't even know necessarily how reliable those are. But
well, good news, my friend. I have those open here right now.
So, we don't need to run through the actual math. The numbers are just going to sound like nonsense to listeners when they're just run off at a very rapid succession. But I think if you go from season 16-ish through 22, 23, 24, you will notice that it is a pretty steady decline in viewership, with the very notable exception of season 19.
Okay, I actually noticed the exact opposite of that. So if I take that time frame of Micronesia through Redemption Island, for the aggregate figure that Wikipedia lists on the far right for millions of viewers, and again, take this all with copious grains of salt, Samoa actually has the lowest figure in that entire range, 12.3 compared to, I would say, an average of like a mid to high 12, and then 13s in there as well. And then for the premiere, Samoa gets 11.6 compared to 13.6 for Token Genes, 14.1 for Heroes vs. Villains, which you would expect there to be a bump for Heroes vs. Villains, just given the nature of the season. But Nicaragua might be a better comparison than that, and you've got 12.2 for that. And then Redemption Island is where the fall really starts. We drop to an 11 there. And then even just looking at the finale, let's say, Samoa does have one of the highest rated finales. So work that into the equation however you will. Maybe that is the Russell effect or whatever, but it doesn't seem like Samoa by itself really stands out compared to the season that came before it or the seasons that came after it. So even if there was some self-contained Samoa effect, it doesn't seem like that had any kind of permanent knock-on effect in boosting Survivor's popularity.
Okay, so you really did make me go back and look up the Survivor Samoa Wikipedia, because I am that petty in this situation. What I am getting at, and I'm putting this one on you for misrepresenting to me these numbers here, is Samoa spent the first couple of episodes, the first few episodes, right around in the mid-11s or so. And maybe I'm making this up, but the sense I got as I was hastily scrolling through the Wikipedia of the neighboring seasons was that Samoa going from mid-11s up to, after the first few episodes, now I'm scrolling through some mid-12s, we're coming close to 13 here, and then the finale hitting almost a 14, I thought was one of the higher numbers I came across in that entire stretch of like 8 or 9 seasons.
Mm-hmm. And
so gaining numbers, over time, I think, is what separates Samoa from what I thought I saw from the others.
Well, what's weird about that is it kind of jumps around a lot. So you do have this peak towards the middle to end of the season, and then it kind of drops off again back to like a low 12 and then up again for the final two episodes. So you would think if there were people who were just enthralled by the concept of Russell Hanson, they would be tuning in every week once they were hooked, and that you would see that bump carry on over time. And it doesn't seem like that was quite the case. So I'd be keen to know what was going on there. And for any one episode, there's usually some confounding variable. Like maybe there was, it was going against something else in that time slot, or there was some other distraction going on that week. But there doesn't seem like there's a noticeable pattern there, really.
So I did think it was absolutely worth mentioning that as all of these years are passing, streaming services and things of that nature are becoming a lot more prevalent. People watching things on demand, DVRs becoming not staples, but certainly a lot more common. And live viewership numbers across the board dwindling, and, you know, network TV probably by that time being close to the point, at least, that breaking even felt like a big win for a lot of time slots. And that is definitely worth flagging up. It's an extraordinarily uphill battle for the people trying to boost these numbers with every passing year. But I also think it is worth flagging up that starting with season 21, excuse me, of course, we remember that Survivor now switches to Wednesdays, which is going to give it, as far as I would be concerned, a bit more of an advantage. And even with that, the numbers start going back down again. As soon as Russell is no longer on the screen, we hit 11s and 12s quite regularly in 21. And by the time we get to 24, we're down into like single digits.
Yeah, I guess you could draw some kind of a political analogy here where there's a question of, are you just trying to maximize raw turnout, or are you trying to target specific demographics in your audience? And are you actually boosting your audience, or are you just shuffling those numbers around between these different groups of people? And I wonder if Russell, at the same time, because he is naturally a polarizing figure, right? It's not like he is universally beloved. There will be a sizable segment of the audience who finds Russell completely repellent. And maybe they keep hate watching your show anyway. And for the purposes of an advertiser, a hate watcher may be just as well and good as someone who's watching because they love this guy and can't get enough. But yeah, I can imagine, especially given, ironically, the tack the show has taken towards being this very family-friendly product that the whole household, the entire nuclear family can gather around the television and watch together. Russell is not PG-13, right? He's not someone who, if you're, maybe a religious figure who's like clutching your pearls or whatever, and you like the show because it doesn't really challenge your values. You see Russell Hans lying about being a firefighter in Katrina or whatever, and burning people's possessions and so on. Like, maybe that's not something you want your kids watching, right? So I could see those people being like sloughed off and being replaced by this new, very intense kind of hardcore strategy fan who watches the show because Russell doesn't seem to have those social graces or that the usual kind of conventions that people abide by.
So I definitely want to get into this next, but to quickly wrap up on just the ratings element, my takeaway, and again, this was with a very quick skimming, a perusal, it means the opposite of what I think it means, but now I don't remember which one I initially thought it meant. It either means to skim something or to go through it very thoroughly, but I don't... Which one is it, Dom?
Perusing is the opposite of skimming. It does mean to really take your time and look over something
okay,
carefully.
I feel like I thought it meant skimming for a long time. So I was not perusing. I was skimming the Wikipedia. So maybe this is wrong and horrible... air quotes journalism on my part here, but as far as ratings go, my conclusion was I do grant the point here to Russell that he did inject some sort of new life into the viewership. Do you disagree with that?
I think I do. Yeah, like if I just go back and look at Gabon's ratings, for example, which I think is a somewhat natural comparison because it is the most recent autumn season at that point. And it's you know, it's less than a year ago, so if there had been a drop in viewers in the meantime, you wouldn't expect it to be that steep. And the overall trend over the course of the season looks about the same to me. Like, you have good numbers for the premiere, and then those actually increase for a little bit, and then they drop off a bit, so you're getting low 13s, high 12s for quite a long time, actually. And then that dips a bit over the course of the season. But by the time we get to the end, we've got 13 million for the penultimate episode and then 13.8 for the finale. These are Samoa-esque numbers. And so if you'd expect some kind of decline, the fact that it remained about the same, maybe that's the argument. That's what Russell did. But honestly, let's say that they continued at their relatively... what's the opposite of steep here? Shallow, measured decline. Then let's say you present this kind of a Faustian bargain to the producers. It's you can temporarily stop this this slide in your raw viewership numbers for whatever those are worth. In return, you have to fundamentally change the character of your entire show. It seems like they were happy enough to accept that bargain, and Jeff publicly has no regrets about that, even though that is his job, is to publicly have no regrets about the direction of Survivor and present it with this kind of teleology to it, where everything that did happen to Survivor should have happened, there's no regrets, and even the things which, in retrospect, we would have done this differently, it's all part of the journey, all part of the fun that goes into making Survivor what it is today. I don't know if that actually is worth it in the long term. I think if you bolt onto your coalition a bunch of these viewers who have very specific and very strict standards in what they want to see out of the show, and if you're just throwing everything at trying to appease them, then you have to make concessions, and you have to have this sharp turn in where the show is going. And so that is, I think, is the next natural point in this conversation, is viewership numbers aside, did Russell affect some kind of lasting change on Survivor? And I think the answer there definitively is a hard yes.
Yes, I totally agree. And let's hit that from the kind of character angle. And I don't even necessarily mean leaning as hard into Russell as they did, because they would go on to do that with Boston Rob later and probably several others that we complained about over the years. And I don't know if that is necessarily something that they look back upon with regret. But one thing I did wonder about is, when is the last time that it seemed like they really cast someone to be a villain and were really trying to lean into what a great villain this person was? Because I think the natural name that would come to mind would probably have been Tony, but I don't know if villain really qualifies for Tony. He's just such an aggressive schemer, but I don't think the bad person thing comes through the same way it does with Russell.
Yeah, Tony certainly is a one-of-a-kind character, and I could see him going down as like this court jester who Zayn knighted his way out of the game, right? Just got himself voted out early, and that may be, in fact, the fate that they had for him, is we know we have a strong cast, so why not have this guy who we think could flame out in a big way? But that's a nice hook to get people talking about the season. And then we have all these other, this bounty of delights to keep them interested for the rest of it. Turns out Tony surpassed everyone's wildest expectations on that front and became this iconic character for the show. And they were very happy to keep harnessing that and to keep going back to that well, casting these Tony imitators to keep that legend going. But yeah, it's really tough to come up with an example of someone who not just was a villain, not just was earmarked as maybe the audience is going to love to hate this guy, but someone who they built their entire promotional strategy for the show around. And maybe that's just the nature of the show nowadays, is no one gets promoted in that way, not the heroes, not the villains. It is tough to imagine that kind of focus being given to literally anybody, even some of the most beloved characters in the show's run since then. That's just,
well,
not how the show works anymore.
Sorry, they did... In their endgame promos for Winners at War, I definitely remember the double episode promo was something like double the challenges, double the vote on blindsides, and double the Tony. They were going really hard with Tony.
Well, okay, this is that's the promotional episode for the finale in a season which, by that point, you're hoping either everyone has been watching already or you're hooking people in, these lapsed fans who maybe watch parts of the season, miss a few episodes in there, but you want to hook them back in for the finale. And also on this all-returning player season where, you know, there is some frame of reference for who these people are already. I think that's a categorically different discussion from, season 41, excuse me, is airing next fall, and we're going to have our entire marketing strategy for months in advance be based around this one person that we've cast on the show.
I agree with that for sure. But in trying to come up with the closest thing I feel like I remember, other than obviously like Dan on Island of the Idols, or, that's a whole separate situation by itself. I feel like the kind of hardest they go at people these days and in recent years is like the Drew Christie, Chris Noble kind of edit.
And to be clear, the Dan Speedo thing, that's just... he did things which merited his being expelled from the game. That just is real life villainy. As opposed to, we are a show trying to tell a story that is going to have big characters and heroes and villains, and who can we slot into that villain role? Sometimes people slot themselves into that role for you, and at that point your hands are effectively tied.
You know who actually,
being honest about it at all. Yeah, go ahead.
Another good candidate, I would say, for someone that I guess you would probably qualify as a villain. Dan Foley.
Just all Dans are...
Yeah.
Hey, Dan, all Dans are bastards, yeah. I seem to recall in Nicaragua, there was a lot of promo mid-season about just what crazy antics will Nayonka be up to next time, but that was close in time frame to Samoa, you know, it's only a year apart. And then also, this was mid-season. It's not like back in August, everyone was abuzz over... have you heard the whispers about this Nayonka character? Like, what crazy stuff is she going to get up to? That just wasn't it. Whereas with Samoa, like you said, pre-season, the water cooler was already talking about, hey, you know that show Survivor? Like, I heard there's this guy who's a real asshole this season. Are you going to check that out? Like, that was a core plank of their marketing there.
I want to say that the promos literally showed him dumping out the water and lighting socks on fire. I think, like, they were really... straightforward about like just how extreme this is going to be, but even beyond the potential kind of easing away from such overt villainy in subsequent years and in the subsequent decade potentially, I do think there are some very, very meaningful changes that have been made that may not necessarily come to mind as... of course, that's a direct response to Russell Hantz, but I do think that Russell being as active as he was with the hidden immunity idols and finding so many without clues and playing so many so often really set a bar for the producers that they have spent the last decade trying to clear and keep one-upping themselves with every season being the most exciting and having the most blindsides and so forth. I think that is one of the more underrated ways that Russell has affected the show going forward, is the degree to which he has made them feel like anything less than that would be unsatisfying.
Yeah, I do get the impulse if you think you have struck gold with your casting for a season. You have either just a great cast overall, this fantastic ensemble, or just one person who you think is just electric TV, who's going to keep people interested. It makes sense to build your promotion and so on around that one person while you have them, right? So if you don't do it for Samoa, you might not get to do it for Nicaragua or whatever, so do it while you still can. That being said, you might argue that just the idea that you need to do that in the first place demonstrates a lack of faith in the show's basic formula, that it needs to be revitalized. It needs to have some new twist, some new character where they now are the attraction as opposed to Survivor itself being the attraction. And you kind of see this with Russell trying to do other shows himself afterwards on the same network, and then Russell being this media commodity where if the attraction is not Survivor, it's Russell, then hey, why not get Russell to do as much Russell things on other platforms as you possibly can, right? Same thing with Boston Rob, where Rob wins Redemption Island and that's all well and good, but then afterwards you get and even before that you had Rob doing all these different TV projects, and Boston Rob the character was the story in a way that Survivor itself wasn't. That was just one more venue for him to express all his Boston Robness. And so there is that danger where if you make it all about an individual cast member, then that only works as long as that cast member is still there. So maybe that tides you over in the short term, but unless you plan to put Russell on every season, which I guess in 2009 you have Samoa, Heroes vs. Villains, and then we take a season off for Nicaragua, which was widely panned by most fans, and then we have Redemption Island, which Russell is on, albeit only for a few episodes. You know, when you have and then Brandon Hands yep. on the very next season. So when you have 4 out of 5 consecutive seasons containing a member of the Hands Hold, if you like, then maybe it did seem like a permanent fixture at that point. And, Sean Hands was going to be on Philippines or something, and this was going to be the new order of things. But this is a danger with in a cast which refreshes itself every season, you can't cling too closely to one cast member. And I guess you kind of feel the challenge, right? And you can say, hey, you thought Bananas was bad last season? Wait, get a load of what's going to happen on season 36 when he's playing for his 20th time. You can't do that with Russell Hands as much as you might like to. So I think it's really difficult to do that unless you think you can find more Russell Hanses or more, I guess on the other extreme, more Rupers, more just like world historic characters in the Survivor universe that are going to keep the interest in the show going. And unless you have revamped your casting processes somehow to in a way that you think that might happen now, because before, yeah, maybe you would get a Rupert or a Stephanie LaGrosa or even a Yao Man, I think, did not have that kind of enduring popularity. And he's the other example that comes to mind. Maybe Ozzy, who, yeah, we've seen Ozzy and lots of dinosaur Ozzy's after that. You have a handful of names, but you don't always know at the time that that's what you've got, right? I don't know if Suri, for example, going into filming for Survivor Panama, if they thought, okay, we're going to get 4 seasons and a movie out of Suri, and that's going to be great. So it's hard to know that in advance. And then even afterwards, like, you can't recreate that same magic. You can try to get these kind of funhouse Hall of Mirrors reflections of Ozzy or Suri or whoever, but it's not going to work. It just doesn't. We spoke about how Colleen, captured the hearts of America, right? And then every season for the first few seasons, you had progressively less convincing iterations of Colleen. So yeah, Elizabeth Hasselberg, okay, sure, I can kind of see it back then that worked. And then Africa is like, okay, well, I know someone here is meant to be the Colleen, but not sure anyone's really rising to the occasion. And then Marquesas, and then you get to Penny Ramsey in Thailand, and at that point all bets are off. You really can't guarantee any success there anymore.
One of my all-time favorite Dom comparisons was when you said Sebastian from Ghost Island was like the Penny Ramsey of Malcolm's.
He really is,
yeah. Or Aussies maybe.
Right. I mean, all half a dozen of one, half a dozen yeah. of the other, right? So I think if you're trying to move to that individual focus model, it's you can't guarantee that. And that's not a recipe for success. And I think that bears out in the ratings over time, where, yeah, I'm sure Malcolm did a lot to energize the fan base during Philippines and Karamoan and I guess Game Changers as well. But I don't know if you look at the ratings, if the suits in the office at the end of the year when they're going through all of their numbers, if they could identify, okay, this worked because of Malcolm or this worked because of Russell / Brandon Hance. Like, I don't know if it actually percolates up all that way.
I don't know about, you know, how high up the food chain it's necessarily going, but I do imagine that whatever conclusions they took away from specifically Samoa, they would attribute primarily to Russell.
I think they would, but does that mean you now need to overhaul your show to a point where I think if you showed even the more casual of Survivor fans, any the Annas of the world out there, if you showed them a pre-Samoa season and a post-Samoa season and asked them to identify which is which, even leaving aside, you know, maybe one is in HD now and the other one isn't, I think it would be quite easy just because of the tonal shift, and even leaving aside how many idols in the game or and so on, I think it would be very easy to determine with accuracy, like, this is the pre-Samoa season and this is the post-Samoa season. And so when you make an attempt to divide Survivor history into eras, you have maybe the first seven seasons before All-Stars, and then you know, you can debate where the next one falls somewhere in there. One thing you can't debate is Samoa and Heroes vs. Villains. That is a sea change. That is you have Survivor before this point and Survivor after that point. And we'll get into the details of what that means in practice, but it's definitely there. And once that genie is unleashed, I don't think you can put it back in the bottle. And this is where this kind of arms race develops, where the show needs to have even more twists and even more idols and even more blindsides every season, because otherwise you fear that it's going to be less interesting by these new standards that you set for yourself. If the formula itself is not interesting, then it has to be these things that you've identified about it. And if a show doesn't deliver on those metrics, then there's just no hope for it, basically.
Yes.
So, you know, Colton, for example, in One World, there have been some questionable casting choices, you know, ethically and so on in the past before Russell, for sure. I'm not saying he's responsible for all of that, but I don't know if Colton gets through casting in a pre-Russell era, for example. And, you know, I'm sure you have other examples that might come to mind.
I wish I had thought of Colton earlier, because he's actually a much better example than Drew Christie and Chris Noble, so good work there.
Well, Drew Christie and Chris Noble, those are the tragic himbo archetype, which is guaranteed TV gold, so I think they make it in there regardless.
We've got to be missing other ones along Colton lines that were put out there to be just as obnoxious as possible.
Right, I mean, you had Corinne back in the before days, and, you know, but maybe even like Philip Shepherd, for example, who I guess you could say that's trying to emulate Coach more so than anything else. But I'm sure if you looked at that like mid-20s range of seasons, you could find a lot of people who fit the moral standards of a post-Russell Survivor better than pre-Russell. And that might be the tipping point that gets them on the show. And in a way, I feel like that almost snapped back to normalcy for a bit a few years after that, where, you know, when they cast, you know, the Dan Foleys and the Wills of the world, I don't think they did that expecting them to be these massive villains. It was just, well, they're obnoxious blowhards and they're going to put their feet in their mouth, but that's okay, that's usual TV casting. I don't think they were going out there looking for people to, you know, blemish the good name of Survivor on national TV the way that a new Russell might risk doing.
Yes, and I'm coming a bit around on the idea that perhaps Russell made them feel like they put their hand on the hot stove and wanted to turn it down a bit. I do think Colton in particular may stand out as someone who kind of the exception that proves that rule, and prove, of course, not being used the normal way there. But I am with all of that and would be fascinated to know what general kind of takeaways they came up with after seeing the reaction to Russell. But as far as the game is concerned, and you set this up very well, I think the advantage of the weak era, as it has become known, has pretty direct ties back to Russell and all of his idols in Samoa. And you know, making mainstream the idea of finding idols without clues. And honestly, you know, obviously, furthermore, credit to him for doing that. That was a heads-up move there and changed the game with good reason. But instead of now thinking, okay, well, we have to bury the idols to make them harder to find, they leaned as hard as possible into that. And now it's a new idol or advantage pretty much every single episode, exactly for the reason you described, Dom, of ever since Samoa, we have to keep trying to outdo ourselves because now this is what the viewer has come to expect, and anything short of that is going to be boring. And if they're bored, they're going to say, I don't need to keep watching Survivor. It's just the same thing every time. And that, I think, is probably a much bigger deal as far than whatever casting or character development kind of adjustments they made after Samoa and Heroes versus Villains. I think the game has taken a massive shift directly because of Russell.
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to the idol thing. The first is just the sheer quantity of idols, which definitely reached a high point in the Russell era and then the post-Russell era. I don't know if it's quite as dramatic a shift as that. So if you look back to when the idol was first introduced in Panama and then Cook Islands, and then became a mainstay under the current rules in Fiji. Over time, you saw more and more idols enter the game. So Mike Nidra, for example, the postmaster of that game, there were lots of idols, you know, flying back left and right. And the only reason I think that it's not remembered as such is that by and large, those idols were not played. People walked out with them in their pockets, either because they were blindsided or in Parvati's case, she found it and they didn't even bother showing it because it wasn't needed. And then Amanda uses her successfully. So in terms of just being a pure idol bonanza, I don't think it's necessarily new, but I think the framing of it certainly was. So with Russell, finding the idol just in and of itself became an achievement, and especially finding it without a clue, which you could say Gary Hawkins did it first or whatever, but Russell certainly did the most to mainstream that as a goal. You know, this is a thing on your resume that you found an idol, let alone maybe you didn't use it successfully, or maybe you wasted it, or so on. But the fact that just having an idol was an end in itself, and so because of that, that became an end for the story in and of itself. And the idea of we are going to film a scavenger hunt and weave that into an episode, and that's going to be one of these shocking moments that we're going to introduce the new music for and so on. That was definitely a thing in the post-Russell era, much more so than before. Whereas previously, you know, you find an idol and that's great, and this is a big moment in the episode, but ultimately, it was an open question of how important that was going to be. And if you use it poorly, you walked out with the idol in your pocket, well, that's on you. And there's we're not assuming anything going ahead.
And I also think that Russell popularized the concept of playing an idol and just immediately finding the re-hidden idol and then playing it again and then finding it again. And not only openly was like playing hot cold with the camera people who were following him around and kind of was a pioneer in the how to work the producers into essentially pointing you towards an idol game. I also think that may have put it in the producers' minds that, hey, the audience isn't going to be that turned off by the idea of now it becoming a routine thing for the same person to find three idols back to back to back and so forth, and kind of normalizing that as like a thing that should happen regularly on Survivor, I think has been a pretty noticeable difference maker as well, considering a couple of seasons at least since then have more or less rotated, or not rotated, but you know, what am I saying? What am I trying to say? Centered around that person and whether or not they're going to be able to find the advantage of the week.
I do also wonder if Samoa coming off the heels of Token Jeans did a lot to make that contrast even more stark, where Token Jeans was billed as a back to basic Survivor season, even going so far as to have the final two when the final three had become the new staple at that point. And even though there were idols on Token Jeans, there was Exile Island as well, and actually a lot of twists when it comes down to it. It was marketed as, and I think edited as, and therefore very much felt like an old school Survivor season in that sense. Even though you had Coach as this big character who would return himself before too long several times, and they would try to recapture that magic with several coach-esque figures as well. Despite all of that, Cloak and Jeans still feels like part of the before rather than part of the after. Samoa is, it is the after, is what ushers in that new era. And so I wonder if you had Gabon, which is much more of a kind of random clusterfuck, or even, it, let's say Samoa was the first post-Micronesia Survivor season, and it marked a clean break, the way that maybe Vanuatu did with All-Stars and so on. Maybe that would have made it seem like more natural of a transition. But instead, you have a vision in some respects of what Survivor used to be, going straight into a vision of what Survivor is right now, and get on board or get out of my way.
So I have a theory that I would like to float past you, Dom. Famously, at the Final Five episode in Token Sheens, Coach Wade, our hero, goes off to Exile Island. I would posit that at some point along that journey, he took the Dragon Staff and drew a literal line in the sand. And that is where Survivor has just kind of been divided ever since. I'm totally with you that I think 19 forward is like a completely different game, more or less. Not obviously, the fundamental elements are very similar, but all of the add-ons that they're tossing in from that point forward, I think, are, like you said, totally noticeable from a person, if you are a person just watching out of order. I think you could pretty reliably place seasons before or after Samoa, even setting aside the 4x3 definition or whatever. But
that would be a great writing prompt, actually, is Coach drawing a line in the sand literally has some magical power that manifests some change into a new alternate timeline.
The new podcast is we completely set aside talking about Survivor itself and just go down that path and do a whole audiobook about that experience. But
yeah, this new format is only happening because Coach drew another line in the sand and we were powerless to do anything about it.
It's completely correct. You know, one feather tied to a grown man's hair flaps in the wind in Brazil and things in England suddenly shift dramatically. But not only, I would say, the surplus of advantages and idols and so forth being thrown in, as far as the effect that it has on the game itself, as far as the TV show itself, I think it is also worth noting that with all of that comes so much more screen time that has to be dedicated to people finding advantages and people talking about how the advantages play into what's about to happen and how they're going to plan around it and so forth. And I think a key reason that the 19 forward and 18 back line is relatively reliable is because of the drastic cut in camp life scenes between those two eras.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the nostalgia for the days when Survivor was all about camp life rather than strategy, and you really got to know the people more as characters, I think that was always somewhat misplaced. Ever since, really, even the early seasons, part of the original old-school canon, you got to know the characters primarily through their interactions in the game, as opposed to their interactions just living on an island together. But there was a blend of the two that kind of kept it all in a somewhat shaky balance. Post-Samoa, that completely changed, for sure. And there was no, you know, when you saw camp life scenes, it was because someone like Russell was doing his best to terrorize the camp and literally burn things to the ground and hide a machete and use camp life to make the game itself as miserable as possible. And that was the hook that you needed to get anyone interested in camp life scenes whatsoever.
Yeah, I feel like Russell spent a lot of time in 2009, 2010, feeling like he came out, even though he didn't win the game, ahead overall on the Survivor experience, and he was able to parlay it into the short-lived, I think it was on A&E, maybe not, maybe like the History Channel or something, the Flipped Off show, which we watched and I think may have even done a podcast about back when that was happening.
Oh, we did several podcasts about that, including, I believe, one that was, there was one Amazing Race episode we did that was Lost to the Ages, and I think that had a Flipped Off segment on it as well.
Probably, and I lost my train of thought there, but what I was going to get at is, I feel like Russell spent a pretty reasonable amount of time while not getting everything he wanted out of Survivor, feeling like it was at least a good use of his time and he got plenty out of it and was happy about it. I don't know if that remains the case, and I don't need us to sit here and speculate about all of the details that went into that, but I feel like at some point along the way over the last decade, that eventually shifted, and I would be kind of curious to know when that was. Not necessarily like all of the individual causes, but at what point Russell's mind changed about, if it even has. But it seems to me like having listened to a few episodes of the Russell Hantz podcast and hearing interviews with him on RHAP and elsewhere, it seems to me like Russell has kind of come down a bit on U.S. Survivor at the very least, and maybe Australian Survivor and that not going well played a role there too. But I feel like at least whatever page Russell himself is on, I don't know if at the end of all of this, and I do feel pretty comfortable saying it is the end of Russell's Survivor career, at least on CBS, I would be surprised if it was like a net positive for him overall. And I don't know what CBS would even think about that. I get the sense from Jeff that they were probably happy in the moment that Russell was providing that kind of spark, but it seemed like Jeff genuinely didn't like the guy.
That might be the best argument for Russell as a ratings draw, is that Australian Survivor saw fit to import him for one of their seasons just to try and drive some interest there. Two mixed results, I would say, given how early he went out and how poorly he distinguished himself in the process. But yeah, it seemed like Jeff gently pushed back at Russell often in the way that you know, Jeff often does, where you saw him challenge what Russell was saying at the Samoa reunion, at the Heroes vs. Villains reunion, effectively saying, look, we appreciate all you brought to the show, but you seem to be fundamentally misunderstanding what the show is. At the same time, that feels kind of toothless when you as Jeff are the one ultimately who, even before he became this all-powerful EP and so on, Jeff was in on the joke with Russell. You know, Jeff was, I'm sure, glad that Russell was generating a new type of discussion about Survivor, you know, around the water cooler on social media that really had not happened in such a long time. And if the cost of that is, well, you now have this kind of loudmouth going off about how he should have won and a bunch of fans who are buying everything he's saying hook, line, and sinker, then that's just the other side of that bargain. That's the price you have to pay. But yeah, I think Jeff would argue his legacy is quite mixed in retrospect. And as you say, Russell himself is also in the podcasting game and seems to have been undergoing some kind of born-again conversion where he seems shockingly reasonable about a lot of things. And I don't know if this is just him clearing the low bar that he set for himself prior, which is a great way to kind of ease into your new life, is to be so shitty that then when you turn it all around, you're held to a lower standard than people who are just trying to do their best normally the entire time. But even on like social issues, which you'd expect Russell to, you would want him to avoid those like the third rail, he actually does sound like he's having a nuanced understanding of things and like giving a platform to other people to talk about them instead. So very, very cautiously optimistic on that front. And I always tend to believe that those sudden changes in character are more of a grift than anything else, and I'm always looking for the signs of the incoming long con. But who knows? And maybe I should be more open-minded about that with Russell Hantz. But I do think, in retrospect, even though his branding is still very much about Survivor, and
the Russell brand. Do you hate Russell Brand? Of course you hate Russell Brand, right?
I loathe Russell Brand. Yes, yeah, but okay. I mean, that would be a very effective, maybe not a title for this episode, but just a, you know, a tagline or something.
A 20-minute rant about Russell Brand.
Yeah, that could be the next segment. Did Russell Hantz save Survivor? Did Russell Brand ruin the rest of TV? but I think that even though he is still, that's still very much a part of his legacy and his branding, I think he is also making an effort to disassociate from it as much as he can, because he wants to move on, but there's no clear thing for him to move on to at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know. And I'm already nervous about how I feel like it may have sounded. Me talking about like what Russell's takeaways must be after all this time on Survivor. I certainly don't mean to speak for Russell. It's very possible that he has reached enlightenment after all of his Survivor experiences and is a much greater man as a result and is tremendously grateful for everything that CBS has given to him. I, like you, Dom, remain very cautiously optimistic about what I have seen from Russell lately. I just, personally, I guess, would be surprised if the thought hadn't at least crossed Russell's mind that maybe Survivor was not, at the end of the day, a worthwhile endeavor. And I think it is at least possible that in the year 2010, Russell is sitting there feeling almost used by Survivor, and it, or excuse me, in the year 2020, since 2010, that Russell is now currently sitting here feeling used by Survivor, and it is possible in the year 2020 that Jeff Probst is grateful for whatever they got out of Russell in the first place, but doesn't really care about what's going on with Russell these days. I think if that is Jeff's attitude towards it, that's honestly fine with me. And if it were the case, I would hope and expect that Russell Hantz, of all people, would understand that sometimes people just get used and thrown away for someone else's benefit. And every time that I think about this, I do find myself tempted to feel bad for Russell if he is indeed regretting his time on Survivor or whatever. And again, certainly don't mean to speak for him, but I get the sense that he is not thrilled in the modern times about how all of this has played out. Every time I feel that way, I then just have to remind myself, if this had gone differently and worked out better for him, I do not feel like Russell Hantz would regret literally anything he did along the way. And for that reason, it is difficult for me to feel a ton of sympathy. And I now am terrified about like how kind of cold this whole conclusion is sounding. But I do wonder, after spending the last couple of days thinking more about this, and hearing your compelling arguments against my advanced statistical research at the beginning of the podcast, Dom, if everyone, including Russell, wouldn't have been better off if he had never been on Survivor.
Well, in theory, you do also have the subset of fans who, if the stories are to be believed, only came to the show via Russell, and who that's the thing. You can say that Russell brought an entirely new audience to the show, but then how many of those flat out stopped watching when Russell wasn't a fan anymore, and how many of those had to then adjust to a Russell-free existence going forward, where maybe he was the hook that got them in, but then once they were there, they comfortably acclimatized to a life without Russell Hantz. And it would be interesting to know if there were more casual fans who weren't genuinely drawn in by Russell at the time and bought into the Russell mythology of he should have won, he was robbed, and the Russell template is the best way to play the game from both a strategic and a character ethical standpoint, who have changed course of that over time and who now would disavow that, or they look for something new in their Survivor rooting interest nowadays, even if they do still follow the show. I do think that when it comes to the change that Russell has wrought on the fan base at large, it's impossible to ignore just him almost challenging the legitimacy of the election in the Samoa finale and the Heroes versus Villains finale, where it has been a cornerstone of Survivor since the very beginning that sometimes you're not going to be happy with the final outcome. And this is true in Survivor Borneo, right, where there were so many people at the time who thought it was a scandal that Rich won over Kelly, and that honestly either of them won over Rudy, who was this American hero and patriot. And if you flip one vote in that season and Kelly wins instead, I think you get a completely different show thereafter. I mean, everything that happens after Borneo is a reaction to Richard winning in some way, and then that all compounds on itself to generate this ongoing and unfolding survivor history. And then in Australia, Colby is America's darling, right? And then he loses to Tina, who was this kindly older lady, and I don't think anyone really had a bad word to say about her, but she shouldn't have beat Colby, right? Like, Colby really should have won, and that was a very controversial result at the time as well. And so that is baked into the format of the show, and if you want to be a Survivor fan, you have to grapple with it at some point, and you can find so many more examples over the years. So Danny beating Stephanie, for example. A lot of people had gone off Stephanie by the end, but there were still the diehards out there who thought she was robbed that season. And then in Cook Islands, which, if anything, is the kind of ideal of what you want that showdown to be at the end, is someone who represents one aspect of the game as strongly as possible in Yule, and someone who represents another aspect of the game as strongly as possible in Aussie. And this was the framing that Jeff himself used in that finale. And if you were on Team Yule, you were very happy. And if you're on Team Aussie, you were really there hoping that Aussie would have won instead. But in that case, I think no one is saying, I have no idea why Yule won. Yule's an idiot. He didn't deserve to be there, and so on. It was just, hey, it's a clash of the Titans, and so one of those Titans has to win, one of them has to lose. But throughout all of that, there was an understanding that this is how the game is constructed. And so, okay, I don't love it, but I've got to grit my teeth and bear it. And Russell was the first one to really, the first of those people who lost to really challenge results in such an explicit way, and to do it in public, to do it in this very messy fashion, like offering to buy the title of sole survivor from Natalie at the finale, just being as sore a loser as humanly possible. And I think that did a lot to warp people's expectations of not just what the game should be, but the ethics of it being any other way.
I think it is, and we certainly don't need to spend time on this, jarring the seeds of Donald Trump that are so apparent in 2010 Russell Hance. It is incredible how many parallels there are.
I was going to say, I want to avoid the lazy political comparisons here, but it really does invite itself. And then the corollary, which again is so obvious that it's hard to ignore, is you now have this, and this is what I was alluding to with the bargain with the devil that the producers made, is that, okay, maybe you have attracted all these new people to the show, but this is your new base now, almost. These are the people who are setting the expectations that you have to pander to. And it's by nature of who these people are and what their temperament is, it's going to be very hard to appease them. And like with Survivor, you can see the seeds of production manipulation over the years, but sometimes, yeah, you're going to get Sophie beating Coach or whatever, to use a somewhat recent example as of that era of Survivor, and there's really not that much you can do about it. So when that happens, you have a lot to answer for to this new audience, and what are you going to do? All you can really do is throw your hands up in the air.
Yeah, I actually almost brought this up earlier, but when we were talking about Russell just being polarizing and that by itself being kind of appealing, I almost mentioned the just like median voter theorem about Russell, even for people not super invested in the show, is someone it's going to be almost impossible to not have an opinion on.
Yeah. And I think it stands out too that when you look at the mid 20s onwards, it is very hard to find examples of seasons where by the end, it doesn't seem like the winner should have won, because it's much more explicitly around crafting the winner as someone who, of course, they deserve it the whole time. And why weren't you on this bandwagon from the beginning? So South Pacific aside, you know, One World, obviously this is Kim's game from pillar to post. Philippines, yeah, you're rooting for Malcolm, but you're rooting for Malcolm and Denise as a pair. And so once Malcolm falls and you're at that final hurdle, of course, Denise is going to carry the mantle forward. Then Cochran and Caramoan, Tyson, Tony, even Natalie Anderson, who you might think would be a hard sell to a certain type of Survivor fan, by the end, like, are you rooting for Missy instead? Are you rooting for Jacqueline? No, of course not. You're rooting for Natalie, who was making the big ballsy moves and really following that rubric. You know, Mike Holloway, Jeremy Collins. And then when you get to Ko Rong, this maybe is the next kind of earth-shattering event in Survivor history, because it is the first real occasion since then where that idealized vision of what you want to happen just collides headfirst with reality. And the fallout from that has been immense, to the point where Jeff, I think, has explicitly said, this is why we changed. the final three format, to this kind of lifeless anodyne cross-examination, where in theory that gives the quote-unquote strategic players, whatever that is meant to mean, a better chance of realizing their odds at Final Tribal. And the prior controversial result then that I mentioned in Sophie and Coach, Sophie has said nowadays that she thinks she would not have won under that new format, because it would have kind of saved Coach from himself, and also framed that discussion in a way that would have put the jury on a different direction.
I mean, Jeff would explicitly set Coach up in framing, I'm sure this is what Sophie means, is Jeff inserting himself would pick up on what the jury is wanting out of Coach and lead him directly down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with her. I don't know that she necessarily would have lost, but I definitely buy that Jeff would have done everything he could to make it go that way. Dom, I know I was deeply depressing in my final thoughts on Russell. Do you feel like, in a scenario where you somehow become aware of Survivor in some other way, and you don't miss out on the greatest opportunity of your life, of course, this podcast, and knowing me, do you feel like Russell, that's the part where you laugh and make it clear that I'm not being serious, by the way, do you feel like Russell was an overall positive or negative for Survivor?
I'm going to say negative, not in an extreme way, but I think Russell set the show on a different direction that I don't think it needed to go down. And there is also always this question of how much of this was inevitable anyway, and was Russell just the figurehead for that shift? So, you know, often when people talk about the influence of certain media outlets, you get this chicken and the egg question of, well, are they actually driving public opinion, or are they responding to what they perceive to be public opinion because that's what their audience is, that's how they need to generate interest in themselves? And so, you know, were it not for Russell in 2011, 2012, when you see this steady decline in the ratings, then are they going to take other measures to try and reboot the show and bring new viewers in that don't involve Russell, but maybe involve some other big character? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's giving Russell too much credit to assign him with all of the, you know, the credit and or blame for what went down here. But it felt like this, it did move the show in a new direction. And if ratings alone was the motivator or whatever, then I don't think that was justified. And also, I do think that this wholehearted embrace of Russell, and you can say that Jeff like pushed back at him at times, but it was very weak by comparison, I think. And I think it involved kind of discarding the faith in the basic recipe of your show that you need to have if you're going to be at the helm of it, and also inviting in this new group of people who don't have that frame of reference for what has happened in the past with all of these outcomes that we didn't like, but we accepted anyway, and gave those people, gave that new fan base this hold over the show that they really didn't need to have.
Yeah, I don't think, actually, that the seasons immediately after Samoa and Heroes versus Villains, that many consider some of the weakest in the run, were as bad because of the things that we've talked about, the kind of negative possible effects Russell has had, because of those things. I think those were actually of the less well-received seasons in the post-Russell era, a lot less to do, weirdly, with the immediate reaction to Russell. I think it is more the current seasons that I think are potentially traceable back to the Russell seed that was planted, Dom, I guess, out in Samoa, where the constantly having to one-up ourselves every week and more or less editing every episode such that we can end in hashtag blindside. I think that is really, those, we're now reaping what we sowed there. Sowed? Whatever. Horrible ending to a potentially good point. But Dom, what else do you have on Russell, if anything else?
I don't have anything else, but I sense that you're not done and that you may have a completely different question to ask me.
I sure do. Dom, I have known you for a very long time. I don't know, outside of documentaries, that we've ever talked about virtually any movie I can think of. We have talked a ton about documentaries. I certainly remember the very first conversation we ever had was about Exit Through the Gift Shop, which we still actually haven't covered on the podcast feed here, and maybe should remedy that someday. But setting aside documentaries, I would love to know what your favorite movies are. We talk so much about TV. It seems crazy that this has never come up somewhere along the way. So let's do that. And before I get the big reveal here, let me just begin by saying I probably haven't seen most of these, and I want to issue a major warning to any kind of like movie buffs out there. My movie takes are going to make you vomit. The list of movies I haven't seen is absolutely humiliating. I've never been a big movie guy of any sort. The movies I have enjoyed, I've typically rewatched over and over and done very little in the way of exposing myself to new projects and ideas, and I deeply, deeply apologize for that. I am absolutely the one in the wrong here, but I definitely need to address that up front, and maybe that is why I have been avoiding talking about movies for the last decade or so. But Dom, I would love to know. Give me one of your most seen movies. What's one of the all-time Dom Harvey classics?
I was going to issue the same caveat here, where for someone who is often assumed to be cultured just because I have a posh British accent, my movie knowledge has gaping holes in it, especially what you consider the most important kind of classic mainstream movies. All a blur to me. I really need to go back and fill some of those gaps. But I'm curious if you had to guess, with the understanding that this guess will be wrong, so I can't fault you for it, what would you say either are some of my favorites, or what kind of movies would you say are going to be up my alley?
So if I had to guess, I would explicitly cheat and use an answer that you gave in a podcast we recently recorded that has not been released yet. But story checked out big time, and I could see this being on your list. Dom, I could see you being a fan of The Truman Show.
Yes, I love The Truman Show, and funnily enough, that would not have come up organically, because I have favorite movies, but they don't stand at the front of my mind, really. So when someone asks me, hey, what's your favorite movie, I really have to think about it. I don't have a ready answer to give. And in preparation for this segment, I actually had to ask people earlier today, hey, have I ever mentioned movies that I like to you, like as examples of what they could be? Because I need to remember those for myself, and maybe you can help me out there. But yeah, The Truman Show would be one of those. It's the kind of movie which you can, we could do an episode about it. There's a lot to talk about in it, and if you want to do some higher level, like literary thing with it, there's a lot to do there. But it is also just a fun, well-made movie. I think it just hits a lot of right notes, very easy viewing, quite snappy. It moves along at a good pace, but it's also fun. You kind of get to bask in the world of the movie, this very artificial world that has been created around Truman, not to spoil the entire conceit or anything, but
I think people know about what The Truman Show is. It's like the Sixth Sense level of ubiquitous.
Yeah, but it's it is definitely a mainstream movie, but it takes what I think is a well-worn concept within I wouldn't call it sci-fi necessarily, but it's a familiar concept, and somehow it has taken over. Like when you talk about it now, you talk about it in terms of, oh, that's kind of like The Truman Show, as opposed to that's like any of the other movies based around a similar premise. Like, it has kind of successfully monopolized that conversation.
Yes. So what else? Starry, are you a dramedy guy, would you say? Or a slapstick? Or what are you, a Jim Carrey fan? What are you into?
I'm into some dramedy here and there, for sure. But I have to ask a clarifying question first. So when you say, what are some of your most seen movies, for you and overall, is that basically the same as asking what are your favorite movies, or is that different? Do you often go back to revisit movies which maybe are not your absolute favorite, you don't think they're the best by whatever standards you like to use, but they're good comfort viewing? You know, it's good to have one in the background, or if you're if you're trying to explain your taste to someone, or just a friend's over or whatever, it's just a good thing to kind of chill out and relax to?
So I feel like most seen is a different question than favorite movies. I certainly, when I get into the ones that I have selected, they are not necessarily my favorite movies, but the same way that I would say, like, knowing someone's most played artists will not necessarily be their favorite artist. They just, for, I would feel like, often represent a point in someone's life. And that is more what I am curious about here, and what kind of movies stand out to you when you think back on movies that have been significant.
Yeah, so for me, The Truman Show would not fall into that camp. This isn't a movie which me liking it really tells you anything about me, or it's not tied to some time or event in my life. It's just, hey, I watched it at some point. It was a good movie, and over the years, I've watched it a few more times. Like, it's just, it's a fun movie.
Okay.
Right? But there are definitely some which I think offer you a window into any of those. So one pair of examples I'll bring up, and this is, it is circumstantial as much as anything else. But I also would have arrived at these as my favorites eventually anyway, would be Monty Python and the Holy Grail and The Life of Brian, which I got into because my dad loved them. You know, he was a Python buff back before it was cool. And not just that, so you know, there's that influence there. But these were two of the only pieces of media that were on labeled VHS tapes in my house growing up. And so if I wanted to watch something, well, firstly, I knew what was on this cassette, so that's a good start. But also, I just kind of watched it myself and seen him watch it or been in the room as he watched it enough times that just this would be at the top of the count by default, even if I had never revisited them in adulthood.
So that is what I mean, is movies that you have just found yourself in situations where you're watching them over and over, and that's a perfect one. And incidentally, Holy Grail gets all the hype. I feel like Life of Brian was their best movie.
I kind of agree with you, actually. Yeah, and their other work, like I know The Flying Circus has a lot of fans
Meaning
out there.
Meaning of Life there, is but... fine, too. Fine doesn't begin to do it justice, yeah. But it was not the other two.
But this is what I mean about it being circumstantial, where the other two I have seen, and they were fine. Couldn't really tell you many details about either of them, whereas I could recite you entire pages of the scripts from either Holy Grail or Life of Brian, and that is solely because they were just on so often in my house growing up. It's not because they are leaps and bounds in quality above the rest of their canon. It's just that's what I passively absorbed and actively absorbed once I became a fan of it.
The opening scene in Life of Brian where the wise men go to the wrong house is one of my top 10 hardest I've ever laughed at any opening scene of a movie.
Yeah, but both of these films are incredible. I guess Holy Grail, unless I'm forgetting something, probably has aged a bit better than Life of Brian in terms of, you know, which one of them is more likely to get cancelled by Twitter nowadays, but also just its own brand of humor. Like, with Life of Brian, it is built in a much more overtly religious society than we have nowadays, and so that kind of direct lampooning of religion makes a lot more sense, whereas Holy Grail, I guess, is more peculiarly English in the sense that, you know, it's literally based on Arthurian mythology or whatever. Not that you need to understand that to enjoy it, but maybe you have to be British to enjoy it as much. I don't know. But I feel like for a British person of a certain generation, like, you can be pretty sure they're going to like these movies if they've seen them.
Is John Cleese like the GOAT in England?
Well, so it is weird because all of the surviving Monty Python members have had their reputations kind of go in different directions, I think, whereas where Cleese has become one of those like aging, you know, semi-intellectual blowhard who kind of is always bloviating about something to some degree, whereas some of the others have just faded into a more happy retirement. So it goes back and forth, but in terms of just sheer comedic prowess, then yeah, I mean, you know, John Cleese is still, after all these years, up there with the best of them.
Yeah, he's probably like the Ted Danson of England, maybe.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe that's a bit of a stretch there. Dom, what other movies from childhood stand out to you?
So from childhood, one, and I couldn't tell you when I watched this for the first time, but in terms of what I've seen the most often and what my favorites are, one that is at the top of both lists basically is I know it's officially called Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I'm going to call it Charlie and the Chocolate Factory because that's what the book is called, and the book is what I first fell in love with. And it honestly, I kind of see why they changed it, because Charlie is really a secondary character in his own movie, basically. Like, you don't watch it because Charlie is interesting. You're captivated by it because Willy Wonka and his whole empire that he's built inside this bubble is so wonderfully captivating. Charlie is just, I mean, he's there and is, by a decent margin, the least interesting, I think, of all five of the kids. So naturally, of course, he is the one who makes it out the other side.
You look like Charlie Bucket. You look like an adult Charlie Bucket.
like a constantly moping urchin.
No, I that is an oversight on my part. I have certainly seen that movie many, many, many times. And yeah, Gene Wilder, just an all-time iconic performance. Do you know Gene Wilder from other things or just as Willy Wonka?
Basically just as Willy Wonka.
He's certainly extraordinarily well-known in America for many, many other things. Mel Brooks, primarily, in a lot of projects along those lines, but plenty of others. For me, when I was a kid, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was certainly on at least a couple of times a year, and that is a Hall of Famer for sure. When I was a kid, I was just rewatching the same stuff over and over and over. For whatever reason, like, me and my friends were watching specifically Dumb and Dumber, Tommy Boy, Black Sheep, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Waterboy. Like, you get the idea. Like, that kind of Adam Sandler, Chris Farley, David Spade kind of, like, my entire middle school years were just the same 10 movies on loop, and then we would go to school and quote them to each other all day.
I'm guessing Superbad was big among your generation.
Okay, if you're trying to get me to acknowledge that I was in high school when Superbad came out, you have succeeded. And I actually may have been graduated by then. God damn it, let me look. Wow. I think it might have been 2006. I'm not sure.
Sure was.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So I was out of high school when Superbad came out. But yeah, so I was just watching the same dumb comedies, and I can't think of any that I have, like, oh, actually, you know what? I'm so glad that that you brought up watching one with your family. The one movie that stands out to me that I rewatched over and over with my family, and it is a classic, and I don't know how many people even remember it, starring Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss. What About Bob? Dom, I'll be very surprised if you've ever seen this movie, but it is a banger. Bill Murray is a patient of a psychiatrist who goes on vacation, and his patient, like, follows him there and still is super clingy and needs help from him. And it's great. But that is the one, for whatever reason, that stands out from childhood. But Dom, in your later years, now as a wise old man...
I will get into... what I've been liking in my aged years, but I do want to highlight one more childhood movie quickly. And I bring this up because I think this is a type of childhood movie that I don't know if this is unique to the exact type of schooling experience that I had, but did you in school ever watch, like, foreign language movies in, like, French class or something?
So, yeah, I mean, we watched, like, Finding Nemo in Spanish.
Well, I don't mean that. I mean movies that were in another language to begin with.
Probably.
Because I feel like for certainly a type of British person, that's how they got into, you know, if they're a big foreign film buff, that's how they got into it. Is they were obliged to watch a movie in French class or whatever, and maybe that movie itself wasn't even that compelling to them. But then that was a gateway into other things, and then... yeah, that's when that whole passion started for them. For me, though, this is a movie which...
Do you watch a lot of movies in Latin?
Sadly not. You know, no ancient Greek movies are on the docket there either. But this was a movie that I watched in French class and just genuinely loved, and then have returned to time and time again over the years, even if I could tell you basically nothing else about any other foreign film. It's just this one exact movie I was lucky enough to be forced to watch at one point, and it just stuck with me. And that's... Les Choristes, otherwise known as The Chorus in English, which is pretty easy to find a good quality version with English subtitles, and I would definitely recommend it to anyone. It's not a... I wouldn't call it a musical, like that's not what it is, but it is a musical film. Music is the subject of the movie. It features prominently, and one of the has an incredible soundtrack, and one of the abiding things that sticks with you about the movie is just some of the scenes where like the writing's very good and also the music is very good at the same time. So we'd definitely suggest checking that out, even with the added burden of watching with subtitles.
Is it a kid's movie?
It's not a kid's movie. It's kind of quite dark in a way. It basically covers this music teacher who takes up a post at an orphanage because he's having trouble finding work. And he's not there as a music teacher, you have to understand. It's just he's a prefect. He's just a staff member. And it has exactly all of the kind of dark plot points that you might expect from going to this underfunded, rundown, rural French orphanage in the 1950s to work. But also, it's a very heartwarming movie. You know, it's a tale of kids who are in a terrible situation, learning to find a certain purpose with the help of this guy who finds purpose in helping them find it themselves. It's a very symbiotic relationship that ends up being portrayed in, I would say, a kind of enriching way. Like, it's not shallow. It's not rags to riches in an easy way. There's a lot of struggle along the way. But I found it very touching. And as I said, you can, even if you turn off the subtitles and have no idea what's actually being said, you can just kind of sit back and bask in the music as and when that comes along as well.
I think that might be the first nice thing you've ever said about France on this podcast. So,
yeah, that's really the ultimate endorsement, is getting a British person to praise something French. But that would be my pick for in the best foreign language film category, so to speak.
Okay. I'm also now, in looking at my list of movies I consider more in my later years, one of them definitely did begin in childhood. A VHS tape that we had for years and years and years and years before I finally popped it in and gave it a try. For whatever reason, I thought the cover looked stupid and I never wanted to try it. Back to the Future, for sure, has been one of my favorite movies ever and made it onto my list of like most seen movies as an adult as well. I am a huge, huge Back to the Future fan, and also now remember, as a child, I was rewatching Men in Black on loop. Dom, were you a Men in Black guy?
I never was, for some reason.
Oh, wow. Too busy loving France. They didn't have Men in Noir? Is that...
On de noir? I'm not sure exactly.
I don't know enough to get to Men. Yeah, sorry. But yeah, I was a big, big, big Men in Black guy as a kid. But before I get to your most seen movies or like formative movies as an adult, now in just kind of looking at my own list, I'm very self-conscious is the wrong word. I stand by these list as certainly among my most seen movies of all time and some of my favorites, but I'm noticing a theme, and I'm not sure how many of them you are familiar with, Dom, but I didn't even piece this together when trying to compile this independently. Pretty much every single one of these has some sort of like heist or scheme or something going on, including Back to the Future, some sort of not a racket, but some kind of complex agenda being pursued that is not necessarily one we can loop everyone in on.
Okay.
So
the ultimate hipster entry point to movie rankings.
I'm just curious about what that says about me now, that these are the ones that have stuck with me, and I'm nervous that I'm now admitting this publicly. But to just quickly roll through my own list, because I'm guessing most people care much more about yours, and again, acknowledging now that all of these are pretty similarly themed. There are definitely some distinctions along the way, but number five for me, in no particular order, but number five that I have just on my page, starring Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell, I'm not sure even how popular this movie was, but I was a huge fan of Matchstick Men, where they're both con artists, and it's a lot of fun. Nick Cage has, like, OCD. It's a great time. And then a much more popular movie, I'm not even sure, how mainstream Matchstick Men became, despite some pretty prominent actors. Number four, a movie I'm pretty sure people are familiar with, at least in passing, The Big Lebowski. I don't know how much time we even need to spend on this. It was one of the most talked. Yeah.
Were you into heist movies and stuff like that in general? So were you a big Ocean's X fan in the day?
No, I definitely saw and liked Ocean's 11. I don't think I ever saw 12, 13, whatever.
Okay.
I'm just not a movie guy. I don't know. I'm sure I would like way more movies.
It's just, is this an offshoot of your adamant philosophy of just never reading a book, ever?
So again, sort of. It's not an adamant philosophy against reading books. It's, I don't have time for books and movies when I do so much on TV and podcasts.
I always question the mathematics of that when that's brought up, but I can kind of see where you're coming from. And as someone who, as a younger nerd would have been very militant about the benefits of reading, and I would have been one of those kids for whom reading is an identity in and of itself. Just the fact that I read books is meant to like elevate me to some higher moral plane or whatever. I have really come down on books as a medium. I think that, I probably read as much or more than I ever did, and much less of that is books than it ever was. A lot of it is long form articles, shorter pieces, columns, just forum threads, just the whole roster of outlets for stuff like that. And books just don't seem to have a natural part of that equation anymore. I don't quite know why.
And I would say the same thing has happened to me, not entirely, but my music consumption has just cut down so much because I listen to so many more podcasts now than I did at any time prior to the last several years or so. But I hope it's clear, and let me be adamant about this if it's not. I am fully aware that I am the idiot here in this equation, and that the people reading books and watching movies are definitely benefiting from doing so. All of the smartest people I know read a ton and watch a bunch of movies compared to watching a bunch of TV. It is absolutely me who is the one who is wrong here. It is just, for whatever reason, the way my brain is wired for my priorities there. But hope to someday certainly come around on that front. I just have never been at a point where I felt like I'm caught up on all of the incredible TV shows that I've been wanting to see for however long. But
on that front, and on a depressing note, one thing that really gets me down if I'm in one of my like existential crisis moods is, especially as someone who has, both of us collectively have sunk hundreds, thousands of hours into this podcast at this point, and for the Patreon episodes, we're doing that intentionally to a comparatively small audience. There is so much more media out there, even for some very specific niche, than anyone could ever hope to consume, that the sheer scale of that just confounds me and baffles me sometimes. And it makes me wonder what the point of doing something like this even is. Like, even the people who do seem to take a genuine personal interest in our content specifically, like, how much, it seems like it would be possible for them to get whatever they're getting out of this through somewhere else. And does that mean our efforts are fundamentally wasted, or what is the ultimate point of doing this? Like, back in the day, we didn't set this up because we had some 5-year, 10-year plan for how we're going to conquer the media landscape. It was the type of analysis of exactly Survivor as a TV show that we wanted to hear. Didn't seem like it was really out there yet. And then since then, there's been this massive proliferation of Survivor podcasts, when back in the day, like, we were one of the first, essentially. And then even RHAP now has gone from a side hustle for Rob to media conglomerate in its own right. And within that umbrella, there is routinely more of the type of stuff that we initially set this up to do on a week-by-week basis from them than we could ever hope to put out ourselves with right. our combined efforts. So it's like, why are we here? What is the point of all of this? And I don't need you to provide a good answer to that, or to satisfy my deep sense of worthlessness or whatever. But it just does. And obviously this carries over to movies, books, music, podcasts, or whatever. Does something need to have that kind of purpose to exist? Even if it is in its very own tiny niche, or is it just you know, part of, is it one drop in a very large ocean that just is going to get completely drowned out over time?
So I think podcasts and probably even just Survivor podcasts are a pretty clear example that no, it does not necessarily need that to exist. But I think what is appealing about podcasts to me and hopefully other people is the kind of on-demand element. And I think the successful podcasts, and I've certainly heard Rob talk about this himself, are those where they are not casting the widest net possible, but they are resonating deeply with the people that are listening. And while the numbers are not necessarily as big as some others, the commitment level is a lot greater. And that, I think, is something we have going for us. And that is essentially the idea, I think, in this kind of media environment, is becoming someone who gets bumped up to the top of the queue when new episodes get released.
Honestly, that would be a fantastic character arc to end this entire podcast on, is we announce this new format, and within the first episode, I suffer such a deep sense of my own, you know, lack of belonging in the world that I just quit the entire project altogether.
I actually, speaking of overlooked things that would have been good bits if we had thought of them ahead of time, and I'm sure many more will come up, I did have the idea that you should, beginning in episode one of the new format, just come in here with a completely different accent. Just act like nothing's weird or whatever. I feel like that would have been fun. But either way, Dom, to return quickly to my own list, and then I definitely want to hear yours. Number three is where I had Back to the Future slated, The Adventures, of course, of Marty and Doc. Number two, Dom, a movie I know you have certainly seen, I would guess, repeatedly. And this, you know, given how much poker I have played, I actually don't think I even like this movie as much as most other big-time poker fans, but I have certainly seen Rounders just over and over and over and over. And incidentally, I might actually cite Ed Norton as my favorite actor in the world.
I have seen Rounders exactly once, I think, and I liked it, but for me, it didn't spark that crazed interest in poker and gambling that it apparently did for an entire generation of poker players in the pre-moneymaker era. You know, it's Rounders brought so many people in, and then by the time Moneymaker won in 2003, they now were the grizzled veterans looking down on these filthy casuals who are coming to the game, but very keen for them to come to the game so that they could take all of their money.
Yes, and I'm guessing many folks out there have seen Rounders repeatedly as well. A great movie, but and also John Turturro very high up on my list, and to say nothing of Matt Damon, obviously great as well. Dom, I'm going to actually, before getting to number one, squeeze in here a technique I can't believe I didn't come up with sooner. I'm going to kind of dogpile two bad takes onto each other in the hopes that the first one kind of goes overlooked because the second one is even worse. So,
I think usually the move is to sandwich a bad take between two good takes. But if there are no good takes to do that with, you know, you can't just you can't put those to waste. So let's hear it.
Yes. So I'm going to begin with one of the more embarrassing announcements I've ever had to make on this podcast, which is, I can vividly recall a 15 or whatever year old Colin Stone hearing about Netflix, this new service that was being offered where my mom would get DVDs sent to her in the mail, and thinking to myself, no chance this is lasting. Who on earth would wait for the mail to bring them their DVDs when they can just go to the video store and pick out whatever they want and be back home in 10 minutes and have everything ready to go that day? Oh boy, was I wrong about that one. I guess I will have to kind of squeeze in a good take here. Shout out video stores. I don't know what it was like in England, Dom, but going to the video store in America was a big time treat as a child. That was all you knew. It was about to be a lit Friday night when you were on your way to the video store. So you may even be too young, frankly, to remember video stores too well, which is terrifying. But I work that Netflix take in at this moment. so that I can have it on the record and it can be swiftly swept beneath the rug as I announce my number one by a mile most seen movie of all time. And I unfortunately would suspect that this is not a movie that is going to register with many people. And if it does register, it's probably not going to register many positive memories. But for whatever reason, me and my great friend in high school, Jeff, became huge fans of a movie. It may have even been Judd Apatow, like an early Judd Apatow project, because the cast leads me to believe that may be the case, at the very least. The movie is called Stealing Harvard. It stars Jason Lee and Tom Green as like the lead roles, and then a stellar list of tertiary characters made up of Dennis Farina, RIP the legend, Leslie Mann, Richard Jenkins, John C. McGinley, my guy from Scrub, Chris Penn, also now dead, unfortunately. Stealing Harvard is about a guy who promises that if his daughter gets into, or excuse me, if his niece gets into college, he will pay for it, and she ends up getting into Harvard and needing $40,000 at the exact same time that he has just gotten engaged and his fiance wants to put a down payment on a house. So he has to get his loser friend, played by Tom Green, to hatch some sort of scheme where they can come up with the money to pay for both at the same time. Incidentally, by the way, it's not listed here on Wikipedia, but I'm remembering a young Martin Starr was in this movie. It is certainly not one that I would go out of my way to recommend to other people, but if it is your kind of movie, I feel like you would understand why it is one that you would deem worth rewatching. Megan Mullally also in this movie, if I forgot to mention her the first time around. This is not even an official Colin Stone endorsement. This is more me coming clean about the fact that for whatever reason that does not even necessarily make me happy about myself, I vehemently feel like Stealing Harvard is among perhaps my favorite movies of all time. Like, I don't think of it as a good movie, but for whatever reason, it just works so well for me. And apparently for my friend Jeff as well. And we spent 100 nights rewatching this movie together.
Christ. How have I not heard about this friend Jeff more over the course of the, you know, going on 9 or 10 years we've known each other?
Great friend of mine from the very, very early days. I think Jeff and I go back to like fifth grade.
Wow. When was the last time you saw this movie?
Stealing Harvard, I would say the last time I saw it is Jeff and I probably rewatched it in like maybe 2014 or 15.
Okay, that needs to be the first thing you do once COVID restrictions are lifted, is dial up Jeff, get the whole gang back together for one more viewing of Stealing Harvard.
I am absolutely certain that he would be down and I would be down as well. There is a literal 100% chance that we will watch this movie together multiple times in the future.
That's the ultimate way to reconnect with someone. And you know that in 20 years time, maybe you haven't spoken to the guy himself in a decade, you don't need to say anything. All you need to do is just Stealing Harvard ? And he'll be there at your front door within hours.
So Jeff, thankfully, is one of very few, to be honest, friends from high school that I still do keep in touch with very regularly. Not very few months have gone by that I haven't heard from Jeff in 20 years.
Is there any danger that you're over romanticizing this movie, and that you now the peak of your life, if you were to rewatch it again, that do you think it would have aged well for you or overall?
I can still recite pretty close to the entire script verbatim. I know, okay, I'm going to enjoy this movie the next time I watch it.
Well, that's good then.
Yes. So Dom, we've probably taken about a solid 15-20 minutes away from your favorite movies. Now my bad on that, but tell me the rest of your list.
So I don't have a list in terms of like an order or anything. My thoughts are not well organized enough for that. But onto a different category, I suppose, in terms of the mainstream recent-ish movies. And I say ish because this is a 2010 release date, I believe. I would say a movie that I would count as a favorite and which I have watched quite a few times is The Social Network, which...
Oh, you like Aaron Sorkin?
Not a controversial pick by any means. In fact, Aaron Sorkin's involvement might be the most controversial thing about it, just in terms of... this movie, I think, has got rave reviews for the most part, but I know that him, you know, as a writer and just his general vibe goes down very well or very badly with different people. I would say I am Aaron Sorkin trash to an extent, you know, where The West Wing is easily my most watched piece of media. Like, if we expand this question to what one episode or of something have you seen more time than any other, by far the top five list is kind of like how, James Holzhauer is like 8 out of the top 10 highest scoring Jeopardy games of all time. By far the most common thing populating my list would just be random West Wing episodes.
Is Two Cathedrals number one?
I don't think it's actually number one, even though I would count that as the best episode. But I love the West Wing, even though, as people may remember from the extensive podcast that I did about it a few years ago, I do have strong kind of disagreements with the premise of the West Wing universe, and a lot of it certainly felt out of touch at the time and has not aged well. That being said, it is still a form of comfort TV for me. So all in on the West Wing. However, I could not make it through an episode of The Newsroom without retching. Like, I could not finish an episode if you paid me, even though you could say the shows exist in the same cinematic universe, so to speak. Like, the tone is quite similar. The shows are very clearly from the same writer. They bear the imprimatur of Aaron Sorkin. Despite that, I just hate it. It's one of my least favorite shows that I've ever seen. So I take the good with the bad. The Social Network for me is an example of Aaron Sorkin at his best. And I think often you unlock his best when you give him existing source material with real characters that exist and force him to work within those constraints. Because if he's just inventing characters out of whole cloth, a lot of them are going to be caricatures. And, you know, there's been so many column entries written about, you know, Aaron Sorkin's women problem and you know, so on and so forth. But when you give him a real life story and force him to bring it to life, he is one of the best of all time at doing that. And for a much more recent example, I would say The Trial of the Chicago 7, which I believe is still on Netflix or easy enough to find. Would highly recommend anyone watch that. I think he does a great job there, and that's with a star-studded cast as well. But The Social Network, this was, as I was a young adult, you know, I was 18, I think, when I first watched this movie. This was, okay, this feels like the first real adult movie that I'm appreciating on its own terms, and it's just a great movie. And I would gladly watch it once again tomorrow, and I think we'd enjoy it just the same amount.
And to totally sign off on what you just said about Aaron Sorkin being brilliant when working within certain constraints, and perhaps deviating a bit off the what I would consider, I know I'm not everyone, what I would consider the territory of realisticness when he's by himself. Moneyball, I recently watched for the first time and can't believe I had never seen it before. But that was also based on a true story. He was writing with someone else and he was awesome with that.
Yeah, Moneyball is an odd one for me because I did not have the same emotional investment in sports analytics that I do in some of these other topics or subcultures. So I could watch that and understand that it was a very well done, well crafted movie, even if it really had no emotional resonance for me whatsoever.
Go for it.
And just going back to The Social Network, I enjoyed that for its time. You know, bearing in mind, Facebook as an entity in the world was positioned quite differently in 2010 than it is now in 2020. At the time, when Facebook was still a relatively young company, bearing in mind its global dominance, the idea that any mass market product like this would kind of rip the mask off and show what I would say is a caricatured version in its own way, but a more honest look at the man Mark Zuckerberg than we really had in the public eye up until that point, where I think people always understood he was like, he wasn't in the mold of like a Steve Jobs or one of these like supposedly super brilliant confident geniuses who could never put a foot wrong until they inevitably do. He was just a deeply flawed leader who somehow became one of the richest and most powerful people of all time. And seeing the actual genesis of that, which I think people didn't really appreciate just exactly what the origin story of Facebook was and how kind of seedy and grimy it was and how accidental its success ended up becoming. Bringing that all to life, I think, did serve a valuable social purpose, even if that wasn't the point of the movie and it still would have been made regardless of any of that.
Sidebar, never been a Walking Dead guy at all, never been a zombie apocalypse anything, but since Jesse Eisenberg, the lead actor in The Social Network, is now kind of coming up in passing, Zombieland is another one from the last decade or so that I've only seen a couple of times, but is definitely among my favorite movies in recent memory. Zombieland is outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Did not see the second one. Sorry, Dom, back to your list.
Well, as I said, not really a list, but just various kind of thoughts on various movies. So that closes the Aaron Sorkin category, I suppose.
No, if we can't handle the truth about A Few Good Men.
There are friends of mine who would hang me out to dry if I said a bad word about A Few Good Men. So I gonna for my own safety keep that one off the list. But moving on to, I guess, documentaries, if we're stretching the definition loosely enough.
Sure.
Yeah, so a lot of the ones that would appear on my list there are ones that we have talked about on this podcast, and I don't think that's an accident. I think the ones that have the most rewatch value for me are the ones that I have the most to say about, and which I want to encourage other people to watch and fall in love with as well. So the Buffy Marathons, for example, have watched that many, many times and still love it, still has the same novel to me every time, somehow, as weird as that sounds. King of Kong, which I did not actually talk about with you. Johnny Fairplay, of all people, filled in for me on that one. But that stands out to me as this all-time classic. And various other ones we've watched as well. Like, I haven't seen Free Solo that many times, just because, like, it's a fairly recent release. And also, I feel like so much of that movie's appeal is wrapped in, A, he might actually die. We might literally be about to watch just this incredibly catastrophic thing happen on our screens. But then also, you know, you watch it the first time, your hands over your mouth, you're kind of gripped by what's going on. The second time, it doesn't have quite the same suspense or hashtag blindside feel to it. But yeah, a lot of documentaries, which if I could see the actual tally for how many times I've watched them, would appear on the list, maybe without me even knowing.
I would say, yeah, documentaries you introduced me to, both the Barkley Marathons and Som, I have watched seven or eight times each.
Som actually is the perfect example of what I said earlier about there are movies on this list which I have completely forgotten about and which I would count as my favorites, but you would have to remind me of their existence to for me to register that. And Som is perfect example there. In terms of ones that we haven't talked about and which I don't expect people to have seen or heard of, maybe so this would be up there with all of the various West Wing episodes. The only thing under the label of a movie that I think would be up there in sheer quantity of times I've seen is a documentary from, I think, 2006 or shortly thereafter, called Beautiful Young Minds. I think, or at least that was the British release. And this was about the IMO team, the International Mathematics Olympiad, and is basically following a group of secondary school students as they prepare for that. And so you have that being the central plot line that runs through the show, but it's also a fairly in-depth character study of a bunch of those people who, as you might expect, by virtue of the fact that they are these mathletes, these like highly exceptional young kids, they're not normal, for better or for worse. Like they have their own personality quirks, and it's both a well done movie, given the fact that it's this kind of like grainy British documentary from 2006, so with all let that set your expectations there. But also, I would say my opinions about each of the main characters have like flipped back and forth so many times over the course of the dozens of times that I've seen it that I actually don't know what I think about any of them or the movie itself, and don't have a strong view about how well I think it's crafted from a narrative standpoint anymore, despite the fact that I've watched it more than I've watched maybe any other piece of media.
So speaking of genius British kids, another documentary I've definitely seen many, many times, The Boy with the Incredible Brain, about Daniel Tammet. And I am now on Wikipedia trying to, in real time, figure out what Daniel Tammet has been up to for the last decade. Dom, what has he been up to?
Well, I thought that hadn't he been exposed as a forcer of some kind?
Is he really?
I remember there being some.
Hang on, this is a big deal. We need to have this resolved.
Okay.
I don't see anything about him being a fraud on Wikipedia in the top paragraph, and I don't see any controversy kind of sections of his entry.
I'm just like brutally libeling this guy because I didn't.
I believe that is the case, Dom, and I believe you now need to recite pi for 10,000 digits as punishment.
Okay, so 3.14159, I want to say 268, and then it's all Greek to me from there.
Okay, well, I don't see anything on here. Maybe I am missing it, but I feel like there would be a whole section if there were any kind of even allegations about this. Either way, why watch the documentary The Boy with the Incredible Brain. I was always able to find it on YouTube. It's another classic. Dom, Daniel Tammet, by the way, only 41 years old today. That's crazy. What others, if any, documentary or otherwise, did you want to mention?
I think that covers most of the ones on my list. And I know now that this topic has kick-started this process for me, I'm going to remember once in a day or two that I'm going to be kicking myself for not remembering and wanting to talk about. But for right now, I think I'm good.
Okay, I believe I am falling into that exact same category. I'm certain that as soon as we hang this call up, I'm going to think of four or five others that deserve a place in this section. But I feel like we have run long enough over the allotted amount of time here, off to about the start I'm guessing most people expected in terms of hitting our 45 minute to an hour or so runtime goals. But Dom, that is finally going to wrap us up here. So thank you guys who have made it this far. Dom is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. You can email us, domandcolin@gmail.com. Hit us up if you have any ideas for topics that you want to hear us get into later on. I believe it is the case that we are going to be releasing these episodes generally going forward. I know this is an early release one. I think the schedule is going to be Wednesdays on the main feed, since Wednesday is Survivor Day, and Saturday over at patreon.com/DomandColin. So I believe that is going to wrap us up here today. Thank you guys one more time for making it this far. We will talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.